Welcome to the Minor Consult, where I speak with leaders shaping our world in diverse ways. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by world-famous violin virtuoso Itzhak Perelman. In a career spanning six decades, Itzhak has delighted audiences around the globe with his exquisite performances and recordings. He's collaborated with countless superstars in classical music, and he's appeared before numerous heads of state, including at the inauguration of Barack Obama. He's achieved many honors, including 16 Grammy Awards and 4 Emmys, and his artistry has been recognized by awards from Presidents Obama, Clinton, and Reagan. Itzhak, welcome to the Minor Consult. It's a great joy to have you here today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You famously fell in love with the violin, I understand, after hearing violin music on the radio when you were about 3 years old. What moved you about the instrument, and what do you think figures into a musician's choice of an instrument?
I think it's inexplicable. I think that you just either are attracted to the sound of the instrument, and it doesn't have to be, you can be attracted to it when you're 2 years old, or 3 years old, or 5 years old, or 10 years old. It doesn't matter. You know, why do people want to, I know people who are attracted to a wind instrument, or attracted to a piano, or attracted to even to a double bass, or whatever it is. It's something in your makeup. So it's you can't really explain it. So, but you just said, I like the sound of this. That's what I want to do. So.
Well, we're glad that you did like the sound of it, and there are millions of us who've enjoyed your sound for many, many years and continue to do so. At the age of 13, then, you appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, and you've talked about the many hours of practice that you put in, starting as a child and continuing through the present. And what drove you and continues to drive you to do the disciplined work that's needed to excel in your field?
Well, that's a very interesting question. When I was growing up, what was driving me were my parents and my teachers. I was not driven by myself. You know, I always say that young kids really do not, as a rule, do not enjoy practicing. Practicing is drudgery. And especially when you are, you know, practice by yourself. See, you don't have a, and it's not like you're sitting in an orchestra and you are rehearsing and you have sort of a people around you and so on. You know, it's a social thing. You know, practicing by yourself is boring as if for a kid. It really is. And, you know, you have to, you know, I have to follow the rules of, you know, the suggestions of your teacher and so on and so forth. And in my case, it was my teacher who told me what to do, which I was not particularly excited about. And my parents who basically pushed me to do it. And so it's, I started to practice for my own, shall we say, out of my own desire, probably when I was like maybe 19 or 20, you know, so that's, and that was, again, not a disciplined kind of a thing, but it was what I call it, practice as you need it. You know, so if I were to play a concerto, for example, and I would rehearse it, you know, in my head, I would practice it, and I would find out what needs to be, you know, to be polished, and then I would do that. So, but the practicing as a young kid, I think, is kind of very, very unpleasant. It's drudgery, you know, and but you have to do it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I was told, and I'm told that. My practicing, I was basically, I did about 3 hours a day, and which is quite little. You know, you sometimes you have kids who practice 5, 6, 7 hours a day, and I always tell my students that after 5 hours, it doesn't help anymore. Yes. You know, it's like putting a sponge in the water. You know, once the sponge is all filled with water, No additional water will make it fill more, because that's the capacity and that's what your brain is doing. You know, after 4 or 5 hours, you can't do anything else. You know, it's enough already. But with me, it was like 3-4 hours. And during the summers, I would go to camp, and everybody practiced five, so I practiced five. You know, I was sure. I was like shamed into it, so because everybody else was practicing, so I had to practice too.
You mentioned your teachers, and I read and heard you speak about your teacher from the age of 4 to around 13, who was very strict and told you, you know, this is what you're doing right, this is what you're doing wrong. Then you came to New York and you studied with Dorothy DeLay and with Yvonne Galamian when Ms. DeLay was Mr. Galamian's assistant. And you've spoken about what a different teaching style she had. And I was wondering, you know, is it right place, right time for a student in terms of matching the style of the mentor, the teacher, with the student's development at that time? And how have you incorporated that into your role as a mentor and teacher? And what advice would you give to students and to parents out there that are looking at different styles as it relates to music education?
Well, that's a very good question. My teacher in Israel was very strict. You do what I tell you, you know, and if it doesn't sound good, I'm going to tell you that it doesn't sound good, and it's your fault that it doesn't sound good, etc., etc. Galamian was close to that, you know. He would basically say, if you do what I tell you, you will play well. And if you don't do what I tell you, it's not going to work. And, you know, so he was a teacher more of the style that I was used to. That plus a little bit of fear, because I was always, you know, prepared for the lesson. I was, you know, I was scared that he would not be happy, you know, because he was a very, shall we say, he wouldn't smile. It would just be all business, you know, this is that way, this is way. If it's out of tune, he would say, hey, that's out of tune. That's it, you know. You got to fix that, scales, et cetera, you know, which I was used to. Now, Ms. DeLay was different. She was, I always say this, I'll repeat it, it's very funny. She would always call you Sugar Plum. Now, she came from right. Kansas. Now, Sugar Plum, she said, what's your concept of G sharp? Which meant, it was a code word that the G sharp is a little out of tune. Right. But she would never say, hey, that's out of tune. She would say, what's your concept? That means that maybe that different types of intonation, and you know, maybe you feel about it that it's sharp, or you feel about it that it's flat, etc. That's one thing. The other thing is that you would play something, and she would always ask you, "What do you think about that? What is your thought about what you did?" So in other words, she would make me think about what I was doing rather than following orders, and In the beginning, I did not like that because I wasn't used to it. You know, I was used to just doing, playing, and then listening to the teacher saying, do it this way, do it that way, that's not good, that's good, et cetera, et cetera. And right now, as a teacher myself, I'm teaching more in the way that Ms. DeLay taught me, which is, you know, the kids play. I want to involve the student in the process of learning. Because I feel that if you figure it out yourself, you know, that means that you make it your own. So you actually, it becomes organic. You know, it becomes you spoke about it. You know what's going on. You know what you did wrong. You know how to fix it, etc. So it's a much more cohesive kind of way of teaching, and I think that it makes you think, and that's really what you want. You don't want to be thoughtless when you play. So you want to know that if something goes wrong, you want to know. Because I always ask the student, I said, what do you think was there? What's your opinion as to the way you played? And usually they come up with fantastic ideas. You know, I didn't do it that way. I didn't do it this way. I could have done it another way. So then I say what Galamian usually says, then do it.
Sure.
He says, you know what, you know, I, you know, when I do it like that, then he would say something like, when I do it this way, it doesn't come out right. So he would say, then don't do that. But you know what I mean? It makes the student think about what, you know, the process. And I think that for me, I feel more comfortable teaching that way.
You've also spoken and written about how to identify talent and how to nurture talent. And I'm curious, you were at a very young age identified it appropriately, obviously, as someone with extraordinary talent. And what goes into innate talent? How much of, you know, success is determined by that baseline talent relative to the practice and the educational experiences that a student has? And what are your thoughts as that applies now to educating the next generation of musical leaders and performance artists?
Well, look, students really I feel that when you come to a lesson, you need support.
Yes.
And I feel that whenever something is not quite right, on the other side, there's something that is pretty, pretty right. So in other words, whatever there is a negative, there's always a positive.
Yes.
There's always a positive. So if I were to say to you, if I were to listen to somebody and they say that really things are not very well with the sound, I would say something like, you know, the way you sound is a certain, you know, there is a certain steeliness to the sound, which is very nice for certain things, but I would like you to do it something that would be of a softer quality and so on and so forth. So in other words, it's not so much of as criticizing by this, but describing what I hear and saying, well, what I hear is you're doing it this way. And this way that may not necessarily be bad for certain things, but yet for that, maybe you should try it another way. Again, it's making the student think about what they're doing, whether they're saying, ah, that's terrible, that's bad, you know, what do you think you're doing? That is not helpful at all. So for me, the support of the student is essential in giving them strength and in giving them assurance that, especially if they're talented, if somebody look as that's one of the things that you really can't teach is certain things that you can't teach which involve talent. Certain things are just naturally, if you listen to, you know, we have in the Perlman music program that my wife started 30 years ago, we always have openings and we get videos of kids playing. And you listen to a video and then you hear a kid playing and they're very, very good and everything is very good, but there is that something there that's not there.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with somebody, you know, they're still extremely efficient, good technique, they can play very well, the phrase nicely, but that there's that something there that is, for me, not teachable.
Yes.
It's something that either they hear it in a certain way, and then when they do that, they sort of carry you to make you listen differently. They move you, and so on. You cannot teach somebody to move you.
Yes,
that's something that's that little thing that comes naturally that you're born with. And that you feel, you can even tell it, you know, by facial expression when they play something and it affects them harmonically and they go like this. And I looked at that and I say, this is a person that has that musical something that is not teachable, but then you can work on other stuff. But there's always that little thing there that is a gift.
Yes.
And I don't think you can teach a gift.
It's such a good point. I, you know, as a cellist and listening to David Finkel relaying his experiences studying with Mstislav Rostropovich and being his assistant for many years, and was talking about Rostropovich was teaching an incredibly talented young player performing for him for the first time, and this young person had absolutely flawless technique, but there was something missing. And Rostropovich described him and said, "Now I want you to imagine a box. It's a bejeweled box. It's the most beautiful box that anyone has ever seen. Now open the box, and what do you see inside?" And the young person said, I don't really understand. He said, "That's it. There's nothing inside. You have to focus. You've got the box. You've got the technique. Now, what do you want to put inside the box?" And I thought that was such an interesting way of sort of drawing the perspective you were just drawing. You have a very distinctive sound. As someone who has loved your performances, your recordings for more than 40 years, there's a warmth and a depth to your sound that is truly awesome. Was that voice always in your head in terms of what you wanted the violin to speak when you were playing? Or did it evolve over time? Because I've seen it as being a characteristic of your playing since the earliest days that I had the privilege of hearing you play. I'm just wondering how it developed and if it's evolved over time.
Well, sound is another thing that you can't teach. Everybody, you know, it's like a fingerprint. You know, you can't, you know, that's your fingerprint. The way you hear as you play, that's your sound. And everybody has different sound. The obvious thing, which is, you know, almost too obvious, is when you listen to three or four different singers, three tenors or three sopranos or three altos and so on. And each one, let's say, is a wonderful singer, very, you know, great phrasing, wonderful musician and so on, good technique. But the voice is all different. You're born with a different voice. It's the same thing. I mean, it's a little more subtle when you talk about a string instrument, or even you talk about a wind instrument or a brass instrument. It's all, each player has the sound that they hear. And how they produce it, assuming that everybody has equal facility, but then you have the sound that is their own.
Yes.
And with me, everybody always thought that my sound was special. It was, you know, whether it was good or bad, it was different.
Yep.
It was that sound that I heard. Mm-hmm. And so there is, you know, I cannot tell you, well, you know, today, you know, I'm going to wake up this morning, I'm going to work on my sound. Let's not say sound. I would like to say tone.
Yes.
Because a sound is the technique, you know, what makes it healthy. But the beauty, the quality is, I call that the tone. And that's the one that is an individual thing, that everybody has a different tone. So if you were to listen to four or five different violinists, they will all sound different.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's interesting because you would say, for example, if I were to play, you know, I play on a Strad, but if I were to play on a less expensive violin and so on, I would still sound like me. Mm-hmm. Even though the violin, you know, might have a different, you know, different quality and so on, it'll still sound like me. That's what I'm all about. And the next person is the same thing. You know, so I always say to my students that they should be obsessed with their sound.
Yes.
I'm not telling you play with a beautiful sound or anything like this. I'm telling you listen to what you sound like. I mean, it's paying the attention as to what you sound like. For me, that's also very, very important.
What comes across to me, and I think to all of us who enjoy your performances so much, is how much you truly convey your love for the music and your connection with the music and with the audience as a performer. Could you talk about that? Is that something that was always a feature of your personality? Because, you know, there are also great performers, technically very accomplished musicians, for whom the expression is much more inward, I think. And I'm not saying that it can ever be outward rather than inward or inward rather than outward, but artists do seem to differ in terms of, And I'm just wondering, when you're performing, are you thinking about the experience of the audience and what the audience is hearing? Are you thinking about what you're hearing and feeling, or some combination of both? Or is it even something that crosses your mind when you're performing?
Well, you know, when I perform, look, I perform for an audience.
Sure.
I feel that there should be something across the stage. I don't feel that a performance should be there, you know, sort of in a closed cubicle, you know, just playing for themselves. You know, I mean, otherwise you might as well just, you know, you can record. And it's nice. But my job as a musician is to convey what I feel about the music to the audience. It's very simple. You know, it's not like I'm going to play like this and it's none of your business what I'm going to do. This is me and myself. It's not me and myself. It's me and myself about the music. And here it is for you. And that's what I'm sharing for you, my feeling about the music. And the thing is that, and I'm constantly thinking, what does the music mean to me? But again, after that, I'm sharing it with the audience. So it's a kind of a current, you know, electrical current, because from the stage to the concert hall.
Yes,
it's very simple.
Yes.
At least to me, it is.
And it comes across that way to the audience. I mean, I think maybe one mark of a true virtuoso is that, and you certainly exemplify this, is that it looks so effortless. And yet, for those who know, it's anything but effortless. But
practice.
Exactly. It's the only way.
Yeah.
How, you know, with any, particularly for string music players, pianists have an enormous repertoire. Violinists have a larger repertoire than cellists, but not as large as pianists. How, and their standard concerti that are part of the repertoire of every virtuoso artist. How is your conception of some of the, you know, standard repertoire changed over time? And do you find yourself still seeing difference, or, you know, playing things differently, conceptualizing the music differently? And what are some of the insights that you've gleaned over the years and some of your favorite works that you perform often?
Well, I find that if people were to ask me, how is my playing different today than it was, let's say, 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I would say that I think my ability to listen is better.
Yes.
While I'm playing, you know, one of the great challenges is to be able to, after a concert, figure out how it went, because you're so physically involved with the way you play that sometimes you're not as good a judge as to how it really sounds. And so I would say that if you can say 90-95% accurate as to how you're sounding, you're in good shape. You know, it's never 100%, because there is a physical involvement that stops your ear from really hearing as to what's coming out because of the way that you're feeling. And sometimes, you know, if you feel that things are very, very difficult physically, you think that it's not sounding good, and that's not necessarily the case. And the other way around too, you know, if you feel that you're having a night where everything is just going so smoothly and so nice, that doesn't mean that it sounds good.
Right.
It sounds good. It can sound okay, but maybe it's missing that little effort to make it really more genuine, you know, as to what the music means to you. The most important thing for me, as I said, I listen better to the music. And so that I'm able to really express the music better, rather than it being involved for technical reasons. I think that's the difference. In my case, I think.
Sure. Do you have performances that stand out particularly in your mind, performances that you're particularly proud of or occasions that had special meaning for you as an artist?
Many.
Yes.
But who can remember? You mentioned Obama there before. Mm-hmm. That certainly was special. You know, every time I would go to the White House, it would be very, very special. When I played in a competition that I won, there was one competition that I won, the Levantritt, and the finals, that was very special. Playing for the first time with a kind of a not such a great orchestra, but playing for the first time with an orchestra was something very, very special when I was like 17 or 16 years old, and so on and so forth. So, and of course, so many either anniversaries or special occasions. So, I mean, at my age right now, it's kind of it's all over the place.
Well, that's wonderful. You certainly have lots of experiences to reflect on. And Itzhak, I've also read that you performed the Stravinsky Concerto for Igor Stravinsky. And I was wondering what your conversation with him was like after. Of course, it's an amazing piece for violin.
He was during the rehearsal.
Okay,
I remember it was in Hawaii, believe it or not, and I was quite excited about it. I mean, can you imagine that, playing this concerto for this legendary, amazing composer? And he listened to it, and I think he liked it. He just mentioned two places where he thought that I could make a slightly more ritardando, and I think that was it.
Okay.
And the rest shall we say, not unhappy.
That's wonderful.
So, and he was a very sweet man. He was a very, very nice man. Businesslike, was very nice. I think we had some dinner together. It was very, very, it was, you know, it was one of those fantastic experiences.
Absolutely.
To play something like that for this composer. And I love this piece. I mean, I just adore this piece.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic. It's a challenging piece because he is very, very much into the inner rhythm.
Yeah.
And the minute you have the inner rhythm, that the performance of that piece then becomes very, very successful. Without the inner rhythm, it's kind of okay. But then, of course, it's all of music is all about inner rhythm. Think about it. Think about Bach unaccompanied sonatas and partitas. It's all about inner rhythm.
Yeah.
You know, anything is, the rhythm makes a performance either good or really, really great.
Yeah, exactly.
So to my wife, you know, my wife, who is my best critic, sometimes I play and then she said, "That was good." That's bad.
Yes.
That was the bad. No, when she says, "Great," that's good. Great is good, but good is not so good.
Understood. Do you have a favorite piece in the concerto repertoire and the solo repertoire? No.
No. The one I'm playing at the moment.
Sure.
When I play the piece, it's got to be my favorite piece, because it's, you know, playing a piece, it's all about being convincing.
Yes.
You know, not staying outside of the piece, but just being inside the piece and being so convincing that it's totally successful with, you know, what you do with the musical phrasing. As I said, the inner rhythm, when do you stop, when do you start, what kind of colors you use, and so on and so forth. And if you think about that, that piece can be very, very, even if the piece itself is not, that's a great, great piece, you can still make that piece convincing. And I think that's the challenge. And especially when you play a piece over and over again. You know, I always say to my students, you know, that one of the, you know, it's almost easy to play a piece for the first time. I know that you get nervous and so on and so forth, but first time, there's all sorts of, you know, there's adrenaline flowing and everything, and you're thinking about stuff. And it usually is very exciting, especially when it comes out okay. The challenge is, what do you do the second time they play it? What do you do the third time, the fourth, the fifth time? Do you repeat the same thing that you've done? It's not like baking a cake, you know, where you have a recipe, you know, you have a certain amount of flour, a certain amount of corn starch, a certain amount of sugar, a certain amount of yeast, you know, and then it's more or less the same all the time. It's not like that. You know, each performance is a different thing. And, you know, you don't have to worry about the cake not coming out. You know, it's as long as you have a variety of performances in your head, that means that you are not bored by what you're doing if you're doing it over and over again. So for me, the challenge is to do it over again. You've got to concentrate on the music, not on the way that you played it yesterday.
Sure.
But the way that you're playing it right now, what does the music say to you right now? And in different times, it will say different things. And especially, you know, great pieces.
Exactly. Orchestras, classical music organizations today are looking at ways to appeal to broad audiences. You mentioned before you're a very accomplished teacher as well, and the young people you're teaching today are incredible. What is your comparison to this generation of young students compared to previous generations? And then how do you think classical music organizations should try to broaden their reach, or is what they're doing appropriate and enough?
Well, look, you know, people are asking me what you think about what's happening to classical music and so on, and I'm really the wrong person to ask. Okay. And I'll tell you why. Is because our school, you know, our permanent music program, you know, we listen to, you know, like sometimes we listen to 100, 110 kids play, and I can tell you that the level of the playing is phenomenal.
Yes.
It's absolutely phenomenal. You know, you've out of 100 plus kids, you know, sometimes we have four spaces because the program is small. You know, we have like 30, you know, 36, 35 kids, 36 kids. And so sometimes out of 100, we have to choose four fiddle players. Very, very difficult to choose, you know, from just that the level is so high. And I think that audience-wise, when I believe in the audience, you know, I think that they know when they hear something special, they know it. They know it. They know it without particularly saying, let's say that, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm a violinist and I know what's good. You know, they know it. It comes across the stage. They know it. And so, and sure. I believe that the situation, you know, of course, the other thing is that it has to do, if you are a clever programmer, then you're in good shape. You know, contemporary music, very, very necessary and so on, but you mix it up, you know.
Sure.
You don't do just one thing or another. You mix up different styles and so on. Give the audience variety, you know, and they would like it. They would like it. You know, it's sometimes if the conductor say, oh, I love this piece in front, I'll say, well, I don't care that you like this piece. Will the audience be able to really fall in love with the piece, considering that if they don't know the piece and they listen to it for the first time? Usually in the repetition is when you start. So in a sense, a player and a conductor is almost not, we have to imagine what an audience would feel like listening to something for the first time. And I always advise an organization to make the audience say, listen, this is the program, get the recordings and listen to it. So that when you come to the concert hall, you don't hear something for the first time. And it doesn't have to be something contemporary. It could even be, a symphony by Mozart or Haydn or Brahms and so on. So, you know, not everybody hears it all the time,
sure.
You know, and so on.
Sure.
Listen to it, because it's all, you know, listen to it. And then you go to the concert and say, oh, I know this piece. Oh, yeah, I like it. It's a nice piece. You know, I heard it like 3-4 times. I listened to it. We used to do all the time. We would go to, let's say, listen to an opera, which we did not know. I would get a recording and listen to it. Listen so that when you go to the performance, you hear something that you're familiar with.
Exactly.
It's always makes it much easier and much more enjoyable.
Itzhak, I want to end with two questions that I ask all my guests. First, what do you think are the most important qualities for a leader today?
A leader. To be smart.
Okay.
And to look forward to, because every decision has a chain reaction. Mm. So if you decide something, how would that affect something else? If somebody can do that, and honesty and transparency, obviously.
Wonderful. And what gives you hope for the future?
You're asking me today what gives me hope for the future. That's a very bad time to ask.
Sure.
You know, things are not going very well today. And I'm just hoping that there will be a leader that would see and that would see what they can do, not just see it around you, you know, as to what's going to happen around you, but see more long distance as to what I'm waiting for this thing, you know. I'm trusting the public to vote for people that think that will give them something. And in other words, to get the right information. That's also very, very important, to get the right information.
Thank you. Well, Itzhak, thank you so much. And on behalf of the millions of people who love your music, love you, and the way you express yourself, the joy you've brought, the meaning you've brought to so many lives, thank you so much for all that you do.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to The Minor Consult with me, Stanford School of Medicine Dean Lloyd Minor. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion with world-renowned violin virtuoso Itzhak Perlman. Please send your questions by email to theminorconsult@theminorconsult.com and check out our website, theminorconsult.com, for updates, episodes, and more. To get the latest episodes of The Minor Consult, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate the podcast 5 stars. Your feedback helps make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to our next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and be kind.